He could doubtless see, too, that she was not going to be a pushover. And she certainly was not. Critical to the USRC lawyers' arguments, particularly in this court of chancery, was the statute of limitations and what the girls knew when. If they'd had information prior to July 1925 that their work had made them sick, they should have brought a lawsuit at that time. So Markley tried to push Grace into saying that she had known her work was to blame earlier. "Did your dentist tell you he thought it was your work that was affecting you?" the lawyer asked as he stalked around the court. "No, sir." The question was repeated. "Why, no," said Grace smartly. "I was working for the Fidelity Union Trust Company when I saw him." They also quizzed her on all the different lawyers she had seen. And when they came to Barry, they asked her, "Was he the first one you had?" "No, not the first one," Grace replied, locking eyes with her young lawyer. "The only one that ever brought suit." Catherine Sharb watched the proceedings eagerly. "Everything was going along splendidly, I thought," she later wrote. She watched Quinta limp to the stand. The judge, Catherine was gratified to note, was immediately concerned. "I notice you are very lame," Backus said to Quinta before Barry had asked a single question. "What is the trouble?" "Trouble with my hip? Both hips, in fact," Quinta replied. "As to my ankles, I cannot wear a shoe very long. I have terrible pains in my knees, one arm and shoulder." Catherine listened attentively. Tomorrow there would be another court, and the day after still another, she wrote, and so on until the entire case was heard. And then the court would give its verdict. Then perhaps I could get away from everything and forget. Still half-listening to Quinta, she started to picture her life afterward, how happy she hoped she would be. Just a few more days of these January hearings, she thought, and then it would all be over, one way or the other. But it was not to be. "I was awakened from my dreaming," she later said, "by the sound of the vice-chancellor's gavel hitting the desk. The vice-chancellor was speaking. The next court day, he said, would be April 25th. I could have given way to tears, but tears would not do any good, I knew. I must summon all the courage I had and fight." Though the delay was galling, the time, in the end, passed quickly. Barry, who was concerned that little was being done for the girls medically, persuaded some New York doctors to admit the women to hospital, and all five spent a month in their care. The physicians believed there might be some treatment devised that would eliminate the radium in the girls' bones. "A Russian doctor," Grace recalled, "thought he could help us with some sort of lead treatment, a treatment used in lead poisoning cases, but it didn't seem to take the radium out of our systems. I guess nothing ever will." Perhaps, grasping the hopelessness of her situation, Grace summoned Barry and formally drafted her will, even though she didn't have much to leave to her family. Despite the failure of the treatment, many of the girls remained positive. "I face the inevitable unflinchingly," said Quinta. "What else can I do? I don't know when I will die. I try not to think of the death that is creeping closer all the time." Death seemed further from Quinta than some of the others, though, as her condition was progressing more slowly than, for example, Albina's, consequently, it was her habit to turn aside pity for herself by commiserating with her sister's plight. Many of the women found just being out of Newark in the quiet calm of a hospital made a big difference to their outlook. "I haven't had anything yet but a bath," Catherine wrote when they first arrived. "I enjoyed that because someone helped me to take it. A maid is a fine thing to have when you are sick." There was one other bonus to being in New York. As Catherine wrote, they were at last safe from intrusion and safe from the prying eyes of unwelcome advisers. For the omnipresent unwelcome adviser, Dr. Flynn, had not stopped trying to get to them, even though Barry had found him out. Flynn had recently told and convinced Dr. Humphreys that he was really a friend of the girls. But the women, now knowing Flynn was a company man, had gone straight to Barry when they'd heard of this. They mistrusted Flynn's clandestine overtures, and at their request, Barry wrote to Flynn to ask him to desist in what the girls considered harassment. Flynn replied to say that he considered Barry impudent, and concluded that he would not bother to respond to the other inaccuracies of the lawyer's letter. The women could not avoid Flynn, however, when, on April 22nd, 3 days before the trial was to resume, they were summoned to a compulsory examination by the company doctors. Flynn, as well as other specialists, including Dr. Herman Schlunt, who was a very close personal friend of Vice President Barker, conducted these tests. Grace flinched as they pricked her with a needle to take her blood. She was constantly afraid of anything that might result in cuts or bruises, for her skin no longer healed. Some dial painters had paper-thin skin that literally would split open if simply brushed by a fingernail. A week later, Grace realized she had been right to worry. In the place where the doctors had pricked her, the flesh surrounding the puncture mark was black. During the examination, radioactivity tests were conducted, the equipment deliberately positioned so that the table itself was between large portions of the patient's body and the instrument. Flynn also held the instrument 2 to 3 feet from the subject, allowing the radiation to dissipate before reaching the device. Unsurprisingly, the company's verdict was that none of the women was radioactive. But the girls' case was not finished yet. In 3 days' time, they were back on the stand for the fight of their lives. 29. Catherine Sharb was first up. "I ascended the steps to the witness stand one by one," she wrote. "I felt quite strange to be on the stand, more strange than I had anticipated, but I took the oath." As Barry had done with her friends, he eased her into her testimony. She cast her mind back to February 1, 1917, to a cold winter's day when she had excitedly made her way to work for her first day. "The young lady instructed me," she recalled, "told me to put the brush in my mouth." Barry took her through her suffering. She revealed she had grown very nervous. The USRC lawyers undoubtedly saw her mental health issues as a weakness, and that probably explains why they gave Catherine hell. She had just said that she lip-pointed, sometimes 4 or 5 times per dial, perhaps more than that, when Markley stood to begin his cross-examination. "Sometimes more," he began.
"Yes, sir."
"Sometimes less?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sometimes you wouldn't put the brush in your mouth at all, would you?" he exclaimed, spinning round to deliver the line. She must have hesitated. "You don't know?" he said, incredulously.
"I am trying to remember."
replied Catherine nervously. "Depend on your brush, too, wouldn't it? The brushes were supplied there, weren't they?"
"They were supplied, yes, sir."
"You could get all the brushes you wanted?"
"No."
"You would go to the forewoman when you wanted a brush, wouldn't you?" he asked, closing in.
"Yes, sir," Catherine replied, "but you were not supposed to waste them."
"Of course you weren't supposed to waste them, but you were supplied amply with them, weren't you?"
The questions came thick and fast. Markley didn't miss a beat, and would have his next line of attack prepared, even as Catherine stuttered out her answer. As they had done with Grace, the company lawyers questioned Catherine extensively about her initial dental treatment and whether any connection had been made in the early 1920s between her illness and her job. Perhaps, inevitably, under such heated cross-examination, the nervous Catherine slipped up. Thinking back to the meeting she and some of the other girls had had in Dr. Barry's office, when the condition was considered to be phosphorus poisoning, she revealed,
"There had been some talk about industrial disease."
Markley seized on it. "What do you mean, there had been some talk?" Catherine realized her error.
I had never connected myself with it in any way," she said hurriedly. But he wasn't going to let it go that easily.
He brought up her cousin, Irene, who had died in 1923. "You know Dr. Barry told her he thought it might be industrial disease, don't you?"
"Well, he had a slight suspicion that something was wrong," Catherine conceded weakly.
"He told you he had a slight suspicion?" Markley asked.
"He never told me that directly. I only know what my folks told me."
"When was it that they told you that?" Markley jumped in, probably hoping for an answer that would kill the case dead.
"Well, I don't know," retorted Catherine, back on track. "My cousin was ill so long, and I don't remember."
It seemed never to end. She felt worn down by it, so much so that Backus, keeping an eye on his vulnerable witness in his court, interjected at one point to ask, "Are you tired?" But Catherine replied firmly,
"No," she said. "I try to sit up as straight as I possibly can because my spine is a little weak."
She would have been gratified to note that the gathered reporters scribbled down that detail of her suffering as they followed her account. As at the January hearing, the courtroom was packed with journalists, even more than before, for the women's story was now beginning to reach international shores. The reporters would later write moving descriptions of their testimony, as Catherine, Albina, and Quinta all gave evidence. The press called them a sadly smiling sorority, and said they maintained an attitude of almost cheerful resignation. Their composure was in direct contrast to those observing the trial. The women listened, a newspaper reported, with pensive stoicism, while ordinarily hard-boiled spectators had constant recourse to handkerchiefs to check tears of which they seemed unashamed. How could anyone not cry, as Barry took Quinta MacDonald through the fate of her friends? "Were you ever acquainted with Irene Rudolph?" he asked her.
"Yes, sir, while I worked in the radium plant."
"Hazel Couser?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sarah Mileffer?"
"Yes, sir."
"Marguerite Carlo?"
"Yes, sir."
"Eleanor Eckert?"
"Yes, sir."
"Are all these people dead?"
"Yes, sir."
It seems Grace may have indicated to Barry that she wanted to be recalled, for she now retook the stand. She had been staring across the courtroom at the gathered USRC executives, and her sharp memory had snagged on one of their faces in particular. "Miss Fryer," Barry began, after a quick consultation with Grace,
You were examined in the summer of 1926 by Dr. Frederick Flynn, and there was another doctor who you did not know who was present at the examination. Have you seen that assisting doctor since that time?
Yes, sir.
Is he here in the court today?
Grace looked across at the executives.
Yes, sir.
Barry pointed at the man she had specified. Is that the gentleman, Mr. Barker?
Yes, sir, said Grace assuredly.
Do you know he is the vice president of the United States Radium Corporation?
I didn't know it then, she said pointedly.
Barker had been there on the day that Grace had been told by Flynn she was in better health than he was. He had stood by as Flynn had issued the diagnosis there was nothing wrong with her. Barker's presence showed just how involved the company was with Flynn's activities. Its own vice president had attended the girl's medical tests. Elizabeth Hughes, the breath test specialist Barry had employed, was on the stand next. She testified that it was well known that all operatives and all workers should be protected from the radium rays, as almost everyone in the field has hand burns. The newspapers noted of Mrs. Hughes, she exhibited a thorough knowledge of the subject and convinced Vice Chancellor Backus, at least, that she knew what she was talking about. That, of course, was anathema to the company lawyers. They quickly tried to discredit Mrs. Hughes, despite her great experience. "What is your occupation now?" Markley asked her, well knowing the answer.
"Housewife," she said, for she was currently caring for her young children at home.
And then Markley was off, with question after question to suggest she knew nothing about radium at all. He rather hounded her, undermining not only her qualifications, but her skill in handling the breath tests, until he had backed her into a corner and forced her to admit that she couldn't define an appreciable amount of radium. "All right," said Markley triumphantly. "I am perfectly satisfied if you say you do not know." But at this, Backus once more stepped in. "I want to know what the witness knows," he exclaimed. "Not merely have you satisfied that she says she doesn't know. I think she said a little more than what your characterization would purport." When the lunch recess fell midway through Elizabeth's testimony, it seemed to come as a relief to both her and Barry. After lunch, Markley returned, still in a pugnacious mood. The doctor who had conducted Molly Maggia's autopsy was on the stand, giving his testimony that radium had killed her, and Markley tried to get all evidence regarding Molly struck out, though he was unsuccessful. "I will hear it," said Backus. "I want to call to your honor's attention," Markley growled, piqued at this decision, "the fact that this girl was buried on a death certificate for syphilis." Markley had good reason to fight this hard for the firm. Having shut down the headache of the orange plant, USRC was now back on track financially. Just one single order the firm had recently received, only a few days before, was for $500,000, almost $7 million. They did not want to lose this case. The final witness on the stand on April 25th was Dr. Humphreys, the girl's longtime physician. He was authoritative in describing their unusual conditions. He testified that, in all these patients, the same condition arose, and not just in them, but in other women he had seen, including Jenny Stalker. Finally, Humphreys had solved the puzzle of her peculiar knee condition. He now declared, "I think she died of radium poisoning."
His testimony was long, and something of an endurance test for the five women, for Humphreys recounted each of their cases in detail, how they had first come to him with these puzzling pains, how he had guessed at how to treat them, and how now, today, his patients were all crippled. They were not the women he had first seen, though they tried to keep their spirits buoyant, their bodies betrayed them. "I thought it would never end," recalled Catherine of his account, "this excruciating, horrible testimony. Yet she was brave about it. It had to be done," she went on, "had to be told, or else how would we be able to fight for the justice that was due us?" And so the women listened. They listened as, in the public courtroom, Humphreys admitted, "I do not think that anything will cure it." The eyes of many reporters flickered to the women, even as their own filled with tears. Yet the radium girls stoically accepted his pronouncement of certain death. Like the journalists, however, Backus couldn't seem to bear it. "You hope to find something every minute," he said urgently. "We hope to find something," Humphreys concurred. "Every minute," pressed the judge again. "Yes, sir," said Humphreys simply. But all the judge's urging couldn't magic up a cure. The girls were destined to die. The only question was whether they would be given justice before they did. The following day, the trial continued with more expert evidence. Distinguished doctors testified that it had been common knowledge since at least 1912 that radium could do harm. Barry admitted into the court record a host of literature, including articles published by USRC itself, to support the doctor's words. Though Markley tried to weaken the impact of these documents by citing the curative powers of radium, such as were promoted by USRC client William Bailey in his Radithor tonic, it was apparent there were holes in his arguments. When he quoted a little-known study in an obscure journal and one of the testifying doctors conceded he had never heard of the author, the expert witness added, "Who is he? What is he connected with?" Markley could reply only defensively, "I am not here to be questioned." The day was going well for Raymond Barry. The doctors were not rattled by their cross-examination in the slightest. One described those using radium as fools, and said he thought that radium curatives should be abolished. "Aren't they approved by the Council of Pharmacy?" asked USRC's lawyers indignantly. "I suppose so," retorted the esteemed doctor airily, "but they accept so many things it means nothing to me, sir." Andrew McBride and John Roach from the Department of Labor gave evidence regarding their part in proceedings. USRC presidents Clarence B. Lee and Arthur Roeder also took the stand. Roeder confirmed he had been in the dial painting studio on numerous occasions, yet testified, "I don't recall any instance of an operator putting a brush in her mouth." He also denied von Serhotsky had ever told him the paint was harmful. He said the first he knew of any possible hazard was after we heard of some of these early complaints and cases. "What was the first case that you heard of?" asked Barry. "I don't remember the name," replied Roeder coldly. The dial painters weren't important enough for him to recall such insignificant details. And then Barry called on someone very special to testify for the girls. Harrison Martland took the stand, the brilliant doctor who had devised the tests that proved the existence of radium poisoning, who had provided a diagnosis to the women where all other doctors had failed.
Barry had managed to persuade him to testify. And the chief medical examiner was a superstar, no other word for it. His forthright, uncompromising testimony stood out conspicuously, raved the newspapers. They called him the star witness. He began by explaining in detail his autopsies of the Carlo sisters, which had confirmed the fact of radium poisoning. It was very difficult testimony for the five women to hear. Quinta, in particular, found it excruciating. As she listened to Martland, one newspaper observed, she approached the verge of collapse. Then, by sheer grit, she seemed to regain her composure and sat through the balance of the hearing with only slight traces of emotion. Martland was unstoppable. When the company lawyers tried to suggest radium poisoning couldn't exist because, out of 200 or more girls, these girls suing are the only ones that had this trouble, Martland replied, frankly, "There are about 13 or 14 other girls that are dead and buried now, who, if you will dig them up, will probably show the same things. I ask that be stricken out as an assumption on the part of the doctor without foundation," said the USRC lawyer hurriedly. "Let it stand," replied Backus promptly. The company tried to say that there are no other reported cases beyond Orange. "Yes, there are other reported cases," retorted Martland. "There is only a stray case, one or two," Markley said, wafting a hand dismissively. But Martland said firmly that the Waterbury cases did exist. His testimony was powerful. Backus even referred to the USRC paint itself as radium poisoning, something Markley pounced on indignantly. "This paint is anything but a radium poisoning," he exclaimed. As the day drew to a close, Barry stood up to redirect Martland. When Markley, predictably, objected, the judge once again overruled him. "You attempted to weaken Martland's opinion," he told Markley. "Counsel Barry is now trying, if you succeeded, to restore it." He turned to Barry. "Proceed." Barry could not be happier with how the case was going, and tomorrow he would hammer home the final nail in the company's coffin. Dr. von Serhotsky was going to take the stand, and Barry couldn't wait to question him on the warning he had given the corporation about the paint being dangerous. That would seal the verdict once and for all, and surely in the girl's favor. The next morning, toward the end of von Serhotsky's testimony, Barry posed the killer question. "Isn't it true?" he said, his eyes bright as he turned to face the doctor, "that you said you hadn't stopped lip-pointing because the matter was not in your jurisdiction, but Mr. Roeder's?" "I object to this, Your Honor," interrupted Markley at once. But before the judge could rule, the company's founder answered, "Absolutely not." Markley and Barry both stared at him, open-mouthed. And then Markley confidently retook his seat, crossing his long legs. "All right," the corporate attorney said easily, gesticulating for the witness to continue. "Absolutely not," repeated von Serhotsky. Barry could not believe it, for not only had Grace and Quinta told him about this, Martland and Hoffman had too, and they had all heard it from the doctor's own mouth. Why was he now backtracking? Perhaps he was concerned about how he would appear, or perhaps something else had happened. "We should get a line on what von Serhotsky is doing and where he is," a USRC memo had noted back in July. Perhaps there had been a conversation behind closed doors that had led to the doctor's change of tune. Barry quizzed him on his warning to Grace, too. Perhaps here, at least, he could find some traction.
"Well, Mr. Barry," Von Cerhotsky replied, "I don't want to deny that, but I don't recollect that very distinctly.
There is a possibility I told her that, which would be the perfectly natural thing to do, passing by the plant, seeing the unusual thing of a girl putting a brush to her lips. Of course I would say, do not do that."
That account sounded peculiar even to John Backus's ears.
"What reason had you for doing that?" the judge asked.
"Unsanitary conditions," replied Von Cerhotsky promptly.
"You cautioned this young lady not to put the brushes in her mouth," Backus said plainly. "I want to know whether at that time you were apprehensive that the paint with the radium in it might affect her deleteriously."
But the doctor was unmoved. His choice of pronoun is notable.
"Absolutely not," he replied to the judge. "The danger was unknown to us."
Barry was bitterly disappointed. Publicly, in court, he denounced Von Cerhotsky as a hostile witness. Grace Fryer, to whom the warning had been given, must have had a few choice adjectives of her own flying through her mind. Barry gave her a chance to speak again. She was recalled to the stand immediately after Von Cerhotsky's testimony, not to discredit the doctor, Barry explained, but to show actually what he did say. But Markley objected to her evidence at once, and the judge was forced to sustain it, seemingly against his will.
"Strike out the answer," Backus commented. "These rules of evidence have been invented to prevent people from telling the truth."
There were only a handful of other witnesses, including Catherine Wiley and Dr. Flynn, who was there as a paid witness for USRC. And then, at 11:30 a.m. on April 27, 1928, Barry rested his case. Now, for the rest of the day and in subsequent days to follow, the United States Radium Corporation would have an opportunity to put their side of the story, and then, the girls thought, hopefully, wondering how they would feel when the time came, the verdict would be given. Markley stood up, his long body sliding out of his chair effortlessly.
"I was wondering," he said smoothly to John Backus, "we may be able to shorten this if we have time for a conference."
There was a discussion off the record. Afterward, as the judge's gavel banged, Backus made a pronouncement.
"The hearing is adjourned to September 24th.
September was 5 months away. 5 months. To put it bluntly, it was time that the girls, in all likelihood, probably didn't have.
"The delay," cried Catherine Sharb, "was heartless and inhuman."
But the law had spoken. Nothing further would be done until September. 30. The girls were devastated. Even Grace Fryer, who for so long had stayed incredibly strong, couldn't bear it. She flung her body down on the couch in her living room and gave herself up to the pent-up tears. Her mother tried to calm her, gently touching her daughter's metal-bound back, trying not to bruise her thin skin.
"Grace," she said, "this is the first time you have failed to smile."
But the girls could not believe what had happened. Markley had said it would hardly be worthwhile for him to begin his case with only half the day remaining,
and thus the case had been postponed until there was sufficient time in the court calendar. The company intended to present approximately 30 expert witnesses. The serial story in the Orange Daily Courier that week was Girl Alone. Well, all five dial painters truly felt that way. But they were not alone. They had Raymond Berry. Immediately he fought the decision and, crucially, found two lawyers, Frank Bradner and Hervey Moore, who had a case scheduled for the end of May and were willing to give up their court slot so that the girl's case could be heard instead. Backus agreed at once to the new timing, and Berry let the women know the good news. The United States Radium Corporation, however, was not pleased at Berry's intervention and said it would be impossible for them to proceed in May. Their experts were going abroad for several months and will not be back until after the summer. Berry was outraged. "I am sure you must agree," he wrote to Markley, "that there is a rather harsh irony in the situation which permits the victims of poisoning to languish and die because certain trained men must disport themselves in Europe." Despite the company's intransigence, in Berry's own words, he was far from finished in this fight. Aware that USRC's procrastination was arguably cynical, perhaps it wanted the girls to die before a verdict could be given, Berry now drew on the feeble health of his clients to fight their cause, asking four different doctors to sign to sworn statements. "These girls are all becoming progressively worse. It is very possible that all or some of these five girls may be dead by September 1928. It made for horrendous reading for the women. Humphreys reported they were kept under a constant mental strain. Yet it was the kind of move that Berry instinctively knew would get results, and he was right. For faced with this kind of injustice, the media were up in arms. Berry's ally, Walter Lippmann, rose to the occasion magnificently, writing in The World, "We confidently assert that this is one of the most damnable travesties of justice that has ever come to our attention." His influential editorial provoked immediate support from across the nation. One man wrote to the news, "Open the courts! Quash the postponements. Give these five women a fighting chance." Norman Thomas, meanwhile, a socialist politician who was often called the conscience of America, declared that the case was a vivid example of the ways of an unutterably selfish capitalist system which cares nothing about the lives of its workers, but seeks only to guard its profits. Everywhere, people were asking why justice was being denied these five women who had but a year to live, said Catherine Sharb, almost in disbelief. What had once been a hopeless case, unheeded and unnoticed, now flashed before the public. And the public was transfixed. Letters came pouring in from all corners of the earth, Catherine remembered. Though most were positive, some swung the other way. "Radium could not produce the effects ascribed to it," one radium company executive wrote bitterly to Quinta. "It is pathetic that your lawyers and doctors should be so ignorant." Some quacks were aggressive in their overtures. "For $1,000, almost $14,000, I can cure each of you," a woman proposing a treatment of scientific baths declared. "If not, I will ask nothing except the $200, $2,775, I want in advance. This means life or death. You had better work fast, for when that poison reaches your heart, goodbye, girlie." Many letters contained suggestions for cures. These ranged from boiled milk and gunpowder to magic words and rhubarb juice. An electric blanket was another suggestion, with its manufacturer envisioning a unique marketing opportunity. "It is not to make money we wish to cure them," protested the firm. "The advertising it would give our method would be amply paid." The girls were famous, undeniably, truly famous. Barry, himself adept at envisioning opportunities, immediately capitalized on it. He broached the subject of courting the press with the girls, and they were all for it. And so, as the month of May 1928 dragged on, and every day seemed to bring forth another call for justice from the press, Barry ensured that the girls were center stage. Close friends Quinta and Grace gave a joint photo shoot and interview. Grace wore a pretty cherry-patterned blouse, with her now constant bandage on her chin, while Quinta donned a pale dress with a pussy bow neckline. And the girls, every one of them, talked. They shared the details of their lives, how Quinta had to be carried to her hospital appointments, how Albina had lost all her children, how Edna's legs were crossed beyond repair. They let their personalities shine through their suffering, and the public adored them. "Don't write all this stuff in the papers about our bearing up wonderfully," Quinta said with a cheeky smile. "I am neither a martyr or a saint." Grace remarked she was still living and hoping. "I am facing fate," she declared, "with the spirit of a Spartan." They weren't always easy interviews. When journalists asked Quinta about Molly's death, she had to stop for a moment to compose herself. Catherine Sharb said in one interview, "Don't think I'm crying because I'm downhearted. It's because my hip hurts so. Sometimes it seems as though a knife was boring into my side." Yet the tragedy and pain were part of the appeal for the captivated public. Radium poisoning, with its child-killing devastation and disfiguring symptoms, seemed to destroy their very womanhood. The public, shocked and saddened, took the girls to their hearts. Barry soon realized how much the coverage was helping, because Edward Markley was spitting feathers. "Personally, I do not like your attitude," wrote the USRC lawyer huffily to Barry, "especially the newspaper notoriety which you are giving these cases. The ethical aspect of trying your case in a newspaper is questionable, to say the least. I am quite confident that eventually you will be properly rewarded, either in this world or the next." Barry responded only briefly. "I am surprised," he wrote innocently, "that you should raise the question of ethics." Whatever Markley thought of the media, however, the firm he represented knew it had to present its side of the story. Predictably, USRC wheeled out Dr. Flynn, who pronounced that his tests showed there is no radium in the women. He was convinced, he said, that their health problems were caused by nerves. This was a common response to women's occupational illnesses, which were often first attributed to female hysteria. The world, for one, was utterly unconvinced by Flynn. Lippmann wrote that his statement had all the appearance of being timed to support the argument of the USRC lawyers. He continued, "It is not part of this newspaper's practice to attempt to put pressure upon the courts, but this is unmanly, unjust, and cruel." Markley was powerless to stop the rising wave of support for the women. When asked for a comment, all he could say was that he felt the girls were being exploited by a young Newark lawyer. Yet the women themselves certainly didn't feel that way. They were leading the charge to bring their employers to justice. At last, the world was listening to them, and they were not shutting up. "When I die," Catherine Sharb told the press with heart-rending pathos, "I'll only have lilies on my coffin, not roses, as I'd like. If I won my $250,000, mightn't I have lots of roses?" "So many of the girls I know won't own up," she went on. "They say they are all right. They're afraid of losing their boyfriends and the good times. They know it isn't rheumatism they've got. God, what fools, pathetic fools. They're afraid of being ostracized." Grace Fryer was also telling truths. "I couldn't say I'm happy," she admitted, "but at least I'm not utterly discouraged. I intend to make the most out of what life has left me." And when the time came, she said she wanted to donate her body to science so that doctors might be able to find a cure. The other girls would later follow suit. "My body means nothing but pain to me," Grace revealed, "and it might mean longer life or relief to the others if science had it. It's all I have to give." She gave a determined smile. "Can't you understand why I'm offering it?" The journalists almost swooned. "It is not a question of giving up hope," one reporter commented after Grace's promise. "Grace has hope, not that selfish hope that perhaps you or I might have, but the hope for contributing betterment to humanity." With such a public platform and public sympathy, the momentum in the case was definitely in the women's favor. And it was at this point that Judge Backus came up with an inspired interpretation of the statute for Berry. He suggested that because the girl's bones contained radium, and the radium was still hurting them, they were still being injured. Therefore, the statute began tolling anew each moment of that injury. It was brilliant. Whether it was an argument that would stand up in court was, of course, still to be tested. But Berry found that, in the light of public pressure, the justice system was now willing to support him. No matter the response of the radium company, the trial was scheduled to go ahead. Toward the end of May 1928, Judge Mountain wrote to Berry, "I will set the cases down for trial on Thursday next. Counsel will accordingly prepare to proceed on that morning without fail." Nothing was going to stand in the way of justice. Of that, both Berry and the girls were sure. Carried along on a swell of public favor, it seemed they would soon be home and dry. Berry was in his office, preparing for the case, when his telephone chimed. His secretary rose, quickly transferred the call. Judge Clark was on the line. 31. Judge William Clark was a hugely respected man. Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, he was the grandson of a senator. The family estate was called Peachcroft. He was 37 years old, with auburn hair, gray eyes, and a large nose. He was also Berry's old boss, back when Berry had been a clerk, for Clark had once been a partner in the law firm Lindaberry, Depew, and Fawkes. "To Judge Clark's office," read Berry's diary for May 23, 1928, "and talk regarding radium cases with him." His former boss had a suggestion to put to him. "Would it not be possible," Clark perhaps inquired lightly, "to settle the suits out of court?" Berry wasn't the only party with whom the judge was conferring. On May 29th, Clark met with President Lee and the legal team of USRC, Barry was not asked to attend. When a reporter questioned Barry about the meeting, he commented, "I know nothing of any such arrangements. I am not even considering a settlement out of court." Though he professed to the reporter that he was more determined than ever that the case will be fought now to the bitter end, privately he was starting to have his doubts. It wasn't that he didn't think he could win. It was whether any verdict would come in time to benefit the girls. Every time he saw them, they seemed weaker than before. Humphreys had already told him they were not physically or mentally able to attend the upcoming trial. Even Grace Fryer, who was normally almost effervescent compared with her friends, seemed quieter and less demonstrative. "I don't dare do much with my hands," she confided, "for fear of being scratched. The least scratch will not heal because of the radium." The girls were becoming like china dolls, wrapped up in the cotton wool of their medical care. Barry wanted them to get justice, but, most of all, he wanted them to be comfortable in their final days. Perhaps, he thought, he should give Clark's suggestion due consideration, as long as any settlement was fair. Barry's musings were compounded just a day or so later, when Catherine Sharb collapsed in church. "Pain like streaks of fire through my whole body," she cried out. "I can't go on this way. I wish I wasn't going to live another month." It seems Barry made his mind up. It would be inhuman not to try to get the girls a settlement if an offer might be forthcoming. Any legal case could take years to fight, and, as Barry well knew from the 4 sworn statements in his files, the women might not live until September. On May 30th, Judge Clark was reported as an unofficial mediator. It was a move that provoked considerable comment within the legal profession, for the judge was intervening in a case over which he had no jurisdiction. Clark, however, said he resented criticism. "Just because I am a federal judge," he asked rhetorically, "does that mean that I cannot have a heart?" His motives, he said, were entirely humanitarian. The following day, USRC held a board meeting to discuss what possible terms it might offer in settlement. Vice President Barker now declared that the directors wanted to do what was fair. He added, however, "We absolutely deny any liability." The company had very good reason to want to settle. Thanks to what it called a cleverly designed campaign of publicity, in which, it said, without any sense of irony, the human aspect of live women doomed to die was played up in an appealing manner. The groundswell of support for the women's case was overwhelming. Settling this famous case out of court would not only make both it and all the negative publicity go away, but it meant the firm could choose when to fight its battles in court. Inevitably, there would be future lawsuits from other dial painters, and the firm no doubt foresaw that it might get an easier ride in a few years' time, when Grace Fryer and her friends were not still plastered all over the papers. A settlement suited the company just fine. With USRC now happy for the cogs to turn quickly, a meeting between Barry and the firm's lawyers was held the next day, Friday, June 1st, at 4 p.m. in Judge Clark's chambers. 2 hours later, Clark made a quick statement to the excitable press waiting outside as he ran to catch his evening train. There is no definite news, but I am confident that the matter will be definitely settled at a conference on Monday.
Everybody seemed happy. Everybody but the girls. They were not impressed.
Radium victims reject cash offers. We'll push cases. Parlays now off, yelled one headline.
The firm had offered them $10,000, $138,606 each in settlement, but all the girls' medical bills and the costs of litigation were to be deducted from that sum, leaving only a pittance.
"I will not grab at the first thing that comes along," exclaimed Grace fiercely. "I will not knuckle down to them now after all I've suffered."
Quinta MacDonald simply said, "I have two small children. I have to see to it that they are provided for after I'm gone."
"No," the women said, "we do not accept." Grace, as ever, seemed to lead the fight. She declared that she would absolutely refuse to accept the company's offer. Instead, after discussion with the girls, Barry pitched alternative terms to USRC. $15,000, $208,000, as a cash lump sum for each woman, a pension of $600, $8,316, a year for life, past and future medical expenses, and USRC to cover all court costs. The firm would have the weekend to think it over. Monday, June 4th, would prove a hectic day. At 10 o'clock a.m., negotiations continued with the world's press camped outside. When, after 45 minutes, the lawyers exited Clark's chambers, they had to use a rear stairway to escape the massed media. They were leaving to draw up formal papers. That afternoon, Barry summoned five brave women to his office. They dressed for the occasion, all wore smart, cloche hats, while Grace slipped a fox fur around her shoulders. Even Albina made it to this most exceptional meeting. She had barely left her bed in the past month. But better than any outfit, more dazzling than any jewels, were the smiles that wreathed all their faces. For they had done it. Against all the odds, after a phenomenally hard battle, fought while they were in the most fragile health imaginable, they had nonetheless held the company to account. They spent 3 hours with Barry, and, in that time, the women signed the settlement papers. The company had kept the lump sum in the final agreement at $10,000, but it agreed to all their other terms. It was a quite extraordinary achievement. The media flashbulbs glared as the women posed for a photo to mark the moment. Quinta, Edna, Albina, Catherine, and Grace. They stood all in a row, the dream team, the smiling sorority, and for this one day, not sadly smiling, but beaming, false teeth and all, in pure delight, and not a little well-deserved pride. The formal announcement of the settlement came from Judge Clark himself at 7 o'clock p.m. By now, a crowd of perhaps 300 had gathered. All aisles and passageways to the elevators were jammed. Clark fought his way through the crowds to a good vantage point from which he could break the news. He cleared his throat and asked for silence, which fell in a soft hush, broken only by the pop of flashbulbs and the papery whisper of pen on pad. Once he had the full attention of the press, the judge announced the exact terms of the deal. "You can say, if you want to," he added unctuously, that the judge did a good job.
The settlement specified that the company admitted no guilt.
Markley added purposely, "The firm was not negligent, and the claims of the plaintiffs, even if well-founded, are barred by the statute of limitations."